For the week of March 25th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 142, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And just back from the Mohegan Sun in Connecticut, I'm Michael Giltz.
And what is the Mohegan Sun?
It's a casino on an Indian reservation in Connecticut. It's the fourth largest casino in the world. I was there this weekend for my annual IRA event, an event where friends of mine get together and vote on their favorite films of the year. And this year we were doing our all-time list, our favorite films of all time, a 100-strong list. So it was a very elaborate weekend. They've been getting together since the 70s. I joined in the 90s. We had a special year this year. We brought everybody together, went to the Mohegan Sun, thanks to Joe, one of our members, who's a big wig there at the Mohegan, and got us great rooms, and we had a lot of fun.
Now, how many people are members of the IRAs, and what does IRA stand for?
IRA is named after one of our members, Ira, so it does not stand for anything. I think they've cheekily called themselves the New York Independent Film Critics Circle at one point, but it's called the IRAs, the awards. They met in college, most of them in Columbia in the 70s, Columbia University, and they're just lovers of film. Some of them have written best-selling biographies of film directors like Billy Wilder. Others have gone on to win Oscars, like Bill Condon was a member of the IRAs for a little while. But mostly they're academics and people in magazines and other parts of the film industry who love movies and go to movies all the time. They love, of course, art house and independent cinema and world cinema. That's their focus. In the 70s, they said, boy, we could do a better job than these groups. We should get together and have our own awards. And they've been doing it ever since. It's just a lot of fun. So it's this year about 12 to 14 members voting on the movies, but it fluctuates over the years, obviously.
Wow. Well, sounds interesting. And I'll tell you what's really interesting is the box office this week. So I can't wait to get to that. But we will be going over a number of stories this week. On today's show, we're going to be speaking with Ethan Noble a little later on. And he's with Motion Picture Consulting. He's an expert on the MPAA rating system. And he's going to try and help us understand it a little bit better, especially since 8 films have gone through the appeals process so far this year. And it's not even April yet. Speaking of the MPAA, they released their annual figures for 2011 last week, Michael, and I know I could see you in my mind poring over all those figures and adding them to our show notes. It looks, frankly, that the industry is earning more money, at least globally anyway. In theater news, Michael's going to try and explain to us why and how Sister Act is still on Broadway. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office worldwide is The Hunger Games, which grossed $214 million worldwide.
That's amazing.
Is there anything else to say? Let's spend 10 minutes talking about this, and then we can talk about the rest. In fact, this movie consumed so much of the market that the number 5 film in North America grossed like $2 million. I mean, it just sucked the life out of the market. Everybody went to see The Hunger Games. I went to see it on Thursday at midnight. I thought it was pretty good, sort of in the Harry Potter vein. It's not a great movie. They could have made a great movie, and it's not a great movie. But if you've read the books and you like the books, it's sort of a satisfying simulacrum of what you read. You know, there it is on the screen. It sort of looks like what you read in the books, and it's pretty good. Better than the Twilight movies, about equal with Harry Potter. Not a great film, but a massive, massive commercial success.
Well, to your point, Michael, the top 12 films earned an estimated $206.9 million here in North America. And The Hunger Games, in first place, earned $155 million. So you're right. It's like all the other films combined only earned an additional $50 million. Not that that's chump change, but it's...
Yeah, it's nuts. They sucked the life out of everything. Overseas, it grossed $59 million, which was immediately labeled as disappointing. I'm like, excuse me?
Well, how many territories did it open in?
I don't know. That's always tricky to clear up, but it did open in a number of territories. But $60 million for a movie with no name stars based on books that are better known here than overseas, which almost equals the film's budget, which was about $80 million or $90 million, depending on what number you use. $60 million is not a bad opening overseas. I mean, if they opened it in every territory simultaneously, which they didn't, that might be considered weak, but I'm sorry. That means it'll probably make $150, $200 million overseas, and that's just not a bad number because it did so well in the U.S. Suddenly, their expectations for the international market have exploded. Well, you know, sometimes movies are bigger here than overseas, or this, you know, will drive overseas box office when they get all the headlines about how big it was, and it was big. That should boost overseas box office a little bit. It was the third highest grossing weekend of all time, period. Opening weekend.
opening weekend globally.
No, it's the third highest weekend of all time in the U.S.
Okay, yeah. Here in North America, it was, and it was the, you know, top opening weekend for a non-sequel, because the top 10 list of all-time opening weekends, they're all sequels.
That's right. And the top 20 is all sequels, except for Alice in Wonderland, the Johnny Depp film, which is, of course, a remake of a very oft-filmed movie. So it's virtually a sequel in that sense. A pure movie, I've never been made before. It's the only one in the top 20. So it's a massive, massive out-of-the-box success.
Yeah, I mean, only Deathly Hallows Part 2, which earned $170 million, and The Dark Knight, which earned $160 million in its opening, beat it.
Now, what was the budget of the movie? This is my favorite thing lately. Hollywood likes to say, we spent $90 million on the movie, but after taxes and after tax breaks, it only cost us $78 million or $80 million. So they want to have their cake and eat it too and say, well, we spent a lot of money, but we did it smartly and got these tax breaks. Well, I'm sorry, if you spent, you know, if you got tax breaks and it only cost you $80 million, that's what you paid. It's not like saying, what did you pay for your car? And you say, well, I paid $40,000. Well, then I got a tax rebate and all this stuff, so it only cost me $25,000. Well, what you paid for your car was $25,000. The budget for this movie is $78 million. There's no need to boost it up and tell us what you would have paid if you hadn't got a tax break. You know, it's all malarkey. It costs $78 million to make, or $80 million roughly, which is a good figure.
Yeah, and it opened on over 268 IMAX screens here in North America, and the per screen average on IMAX, $40,000 per screen.
But that's not actually that much, because its average for all of its screens was $37,000.
Okay.
And that brings up another point. The Hunger Games was not in 3D.
That's right.
Thank God. And I bet it would not have hit these numbers if it was in 3D.
No, that means a lot of people were seeing this movie.
I bet 3D would have hurt it, though.
I think you're probably right about that. People would have said, you know what? I want to see it, but maybe I'll just wait for the DVD because I don't want to pay the extra $4 or $5 times four for a family of four to go see this movie.
Well, a lot of people brought kids, and frankly, it's a very violent movie. And I know it's ranked PG-13, which we'll get to later, the MPAA. Again, the MPAA doesn't mind violence, but it hates sex. And this is a classic example. The movie was shot in a way so that there was not a lot of blood, but there's some very bloody and, violent-filled scenes. There's an initial scene when the Hunger Games themselves actually begin, where people are slaughtering each other left and right. And we're talking about kids killing other kids. And there's another painful scene where somebody has a spear shoved through the middle of their body. Again, it's not gory, and it's shot in a way to sort of engage you emotionally, but not linger on the violence. But nonetheless, it is a violent film of children killing other children. And I was surprised at the number of people who brought like 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, and 12-year-olds to this movie, including family members and friends of mine.
Well, you know, maybe it was part of the reward for having read the book.
Well, the books are very violent. They're not necessarily right for 10, 8, 9, or 10-year-olds either.
Okay.
Well, so, I mean, hey, son, you read Lady Chatterley's Lover. Let's go see the movie. You know, it's not necessarily appropriate. The story of, oh, glad you finished it, kid. Let's go see it.
Now, do you want to run down the rest of the box office for the world, or just
I do, absolutely. The number two film around the world was John Carter, which grossed another $27 million. It's at $134 million and counting. This movie has collapsed. As we always say, we don't like to rush to judgment. We say, hold off, don't rush to judgment. And in fact, we quoted an analyst last week who says, you know what? This movie may not lose as much money as we think. But in fact, you got to wait for the figures to come in. And the second weekend, it got hit by the buzzsaw of, you know, of Hunger Games. This movie only made $5 million in North America. It's at a $62 million total in North America. It's not going to hit $100 million. The same thing is happening overseas. It is, not only did it open not great, but it is falling dramatically. And so this movie is very, very hard. And in fact, Disney announced, yep, we're going to write off $200 million on this movie.
Yeah, just as we were putting the show to bed, finished the editing, and we had that long segment about how this analyst said, oh, it's not going to be that bad. They turn around and say, nope, we're going to lose $200 million.
Well, they're going to write it off. And I thought for a second, you know what? They may be getting ahead of the curve. They want to pull the Band-Aid, you know, get the medicine over with. And if the movie ends up doing better overseas than expected, they can come back with some better figures down the road. They market down here. They get to have some extra profit in a quarter or two. But in fact, they have a better look at the numbers than we do. They could see how the movie was doing poorly overseas. They could drill down and see per screen averages and how markets were doing compared to previous years. They knew this was really not going to hold well. And that's certainly the case. It dropped 63% in North America, probably a similar amount overseas. This is a genuine flop.
Yeah, I mean, in 17 days, as you mentioned, in North America, it's made $62 million, which is less than The Hunger Games made on its opening day.
The number three movie around the world, however, is a positive story, 21 Jump Street. It grossed another $26 million, and it's made $87 million worldwide on a modest budget of $42 million. That's not so modest, but it's reasonable. At number four around the world is Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. That grossed another $18 million. It's at $200 million worldwide. And number five is an overseas debut. It's called The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It grossed, it's not a debut actually, it's been open in the UK for a week or two, but it expanded to some other countries and it grossed $8 million worldwide. It's at $33 million worldwide and counting. This is a movie about old age pensioners who moved to India so they can live cheaply, and it stars Judi Dench and Maggie Smith and a host of other people that your parents love. And my mom cannot wait to see this movie. She is chomping at the bit.
Yeah, I've seen the trailer for this movie and it looks hilarious.
Well, my mom will be there opening day with you. Anybody over 50, this is their Hunger Games. There's even someone from Downton Abbey in it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's catnip for older people. It's directed by John Madden, who did Mrs. Brown. And, you know, it could be a fun, cute little movie. At number six worldwide is This Means War, the Reese Witherspoon film. It grossed $7 million. It's doing pretty well overseas. It's grossed $131 million and counting. At number seven is Project X, the high school party flick. It grossed another $6 million worldwide. It's at $72 million total. And since it cost, you know, pennies to make, this is definitely a very good deal for them. And number eight is a South Korean romantic drama. It opened in that country alone and it grossed $5 million. It's called Architecture 101. And I think when we see these little movies pop up that are big in their territories, like the French film we've been talking about and some other movies in Korea and Japan, it's fun to see that, you know, they could have, if they opened in North America, they would have broken into the top 10. It's good to see that there's a vibrant world cinema, even if it takes months or a year or two to come to America, if they come at all.
Well, we'll be getting to that in just a moment.
And number nine is The Devil Inside, the horror flick, which grossed another $3 million worldwide, still almost clawing its way to $100 million. And at number 10 worldwide is the Denzel Washington movie Safe House, which grossed another $3 million, and it's just under $200 million worldwide.
Well, now, we were talking earlier about John Carter's write-offs over at Disney, but, you know, write-offs and when studios take them, there's all these financial and political reasons and the manipulation of stock price and everything. There's a right. reason why they take write downs at certain points. And so maybe they wanted to get the write down done in Q1 of 2012. Who
exactly.
knows? But it looks exactly. like MGM may have to take a little bit of a loss on Dragon Tattoo. We've been talking here about how much did the film cost? Would it make any money? Would they make the sequels? And MGM Holdings CEO Gary Barber told investors that, you know what, it was definitely below our expectations and we booked a modest loss. And as far as the trilogy and the other two films go, they are talking, MGM is talking to Sony, but following, you know, the disappointment that was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the American version, they're assuming, at least MGM is assuming, that they can get a better deal.
That's right. They said, well, more bang for their buck. They didn't make the film. They just co-financed it with Sony, which was the major power behind the movie. Will they make a sequel? I don't know. The other two books are far less cinematic from everybody that I've heard, which is a big reason why the other two films in the original foreign language trilogy did so much more poorly than the first movie. The second movie made half the amount of the first movie, and the third made about half amount of the second. So this was a trilogy that in its original language took a straight dive down, unlike the books, which sold well all the way through. But I don't know if it makes sense economically to make it. MGM said, you know what? We're not interested at the same terms.
Right.
So one of the big co-financers of this movie have said, gee, I don't know. You know,
well,
a very exciting prospect.
Well, did you see this story about the DVD for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? I love this story. Apparently, Sony, to kind of go in line with the film and the main character, Lisbeth Salander, I think her name is, they created this DVD that had a felt tip marker on the DVD that made it look pirated.
Yeah, I had the DVD itself. It does have, it looks like somebody burned you a copy.
Right, exactly.
And so the problem was that people thought, what the hell is this? Did I buy a pirated copy without knowing? And in fact, Redbox put a disclaimer on its movie saying, hey, you know, it's supposed to look like this. It's just an artistic choice. We didn't rip off the movie and shove it in our Redbox system.
Right. They said, yeah. Note to renters, the handwritten look on the disc of this movie is legitimate and is intended to look like a burned DVD.
Yeah. Overall, I bet MGM is looking a lot more towards the next Hobbit movie, which they are co-financing, than they are The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But we'll have to see if it ever happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I guess that brings us to that's being shot in New Zealand, which maybe kind of moves us along into the global box office.
That's right. I'm a little proud of this. You know, there's a reason Showbiz Sandbox always does the global box office. We're one of the only people that does it regularly. I think we're the only one that brings all the numbers together, actually. Some people post an international box office total. We add up all the numbers and try to give you a sense of what's going on globally in the cinema. And why do we do that? It's the same reason Bonnie and Clyde rob banks, because that's where the money is. Worldwide box office is exploding. And their figures were just released a few days ago. The worldwide box office hit a record $32.6 billion in 2011. That's huge. And it's the first of a lot of interesting stuff that came out of this report that was issued, and it was picked up by Hollywood Reporter and a bunch of other people.
Well, and this is a report that usually comes out in March, second or third week of March, that the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, they distribute this report every year. And the head of the MPAA and usually the head of NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, make their statements. And it's kind of like a state of the union, if you will, at least figure-wise, for what's going on in the at least North American industry. But more and more, this report is looking at the international space.
That's right. And the headline in the Hollywood Reporter, and I don't know yet whether this was something that the MPAA fed to them and that they just took it and repeated it, or whether it was a mistake that they made. But the original headline said, international box office was up 35% in 2011. And my eyes bugged out and I went, oh my God, wow, really? You know, and I read into the story and I looked at the numbers and I added them up and it didn't make sense. It was not true. The numbers that they gave did not work. Yeah. And I put a note in the Variety of Things that what's going on here? This says this. Last year, the LA Times reported international box office was this. This year you say it's this, that would be an increase of about 7%. And this all makes sense compared to this and that. And the other thing, all the numbers work except your claim that it increased by 35% means either they only made $17 billion last year, or it means it should have made, you know, 35. You know, the numbers didn't work. And I put a note to that effect saying that. And they corrected the story. They didn't give me any credit, of course. They didn't even say anything like that. But now they've adjusted the figures. And in fact, worldwide box office went up. International box office went up 7%, not 35%, but a still impressive and strong 7% to $22.4 billion.
You know what I think happened is originally it said 32%, not 35%. And I think that what they were mistaking was 32.6 billion with 32%.
Oh, that might have, you're right. That might have been it. Well, you know, North American box office was down 4%.
We've talked about that. Yeah.
Right. But that was the third highest grossing year in movie history. It was $10.2 billion. So you add those two together, and worldwide box office was up. It was up about 3% because the international market is twice as big as the North American market, $10 billion versus $22 billion. So even though we were down 4%, overseas was up 7%, and the result is that box office worldwide grew at a modest but still good 3% to $32 billion.
Well, as the world gets flatter and as globalization kind of takes place and you got more movie theaters being built in Russia, in China, in parts of Eastern Europe, these countries naturally will start making more money at the box office. I guess one question I have is whether they're making more money on homegrown films the way they are in, say, Poland, where 30% of the box office goes towards movies in their own language, or whether they're Hollywood studio films. I mean, the MPAA...
Well, 70% went to overseas movies, so that's still a big bunch of the box office devoted to French and English and German and all that.
That's right.
Right. So, I mean, I think you see a typical balance all over the world where, depending on the country and how strong their box office, they might have 10, 20, 30% of the box office. If they don't have a strong industry like Uzbekistan, I imagine, does not have 30% of the box office devoted to Uzbeki movies. It's probably more like 90% is Hollywood, or I should say international movies, because there are French films and British films and movies in other countries that do very well around the world, like Japan and their animated movies.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Japan, outside of the U.S., has the highest grossing box office in the world.
Right. And that was despite the earthquake and all their natural disasters that they had in the last year or two.
Yes, that is actually quite remarkable because half the country was shut down. And of course, they were having rolling blackouts for a good portion of the year. So seeing a movie in a country where there's rolling blackouts, that's kind of hard. China jumped all the way up to number two.
And no surprise, the movies made $2 billion in China, about $2.3 billion in Japan, another $2 billion in France, $1.7 billion in the UK, and $1.4 billion in India. Now, obviously, you look at that and you see, wow, there's a lot of room for growth. France grossed $2 billion. They have 64 million people. They really love the movies. The UK has 62 million people. They spent $1.7 billion at the box office. India has more than a billion people. China has more than a billion people. It's 1.3 billion people. So when you, and then you look at Central and South America and Africa, you look at all the room for growth. I mean, China's at 2 billion. There's no reason their box office should not be triple what the US is. You should be able to make $20 billion in China alone once you get that country going. I mean,
well, that's actually what many predict in the next 5 years, that in about 5 years' time, it will be the number one movie box office market in the world.
Well, certainly 5 years. I don't know if that's a little too eager. That's going to be 100%. You know, it's going to have to double and double and double again. I mean, it's at $2 billion now. To get up to $10 billion is going to take a little work. And of course, the country has huge infrastructure needs. I mean, you know, there are hundreds of millions of people living at the poverty level in China. They have a billion people and they have a massive growing middle class. But there are also a lot of people who do not. They live in small villages and they have one TV that they all share.
And I think the same is true of India.
Yes, in India, exactly. So there's a lot of room for growth. I don't know if it's going to happen in 5 years, but they're definitely going to grow. There's no reason why they shouldn't be bigger markets than the U.S. And when you add all that up together, the worldwide box office really, it's going to explode in the next 20 years.
And I guess Hollywood is hoping it does, because I see that here that you had the tickets sold per person in North America continuing to decline. And you say that's my favorite stat.
It is.
In 2009, there were 4.3 tickets sold per person. And in 2010, 4.1 tickets sold per person. And now it's down to 3.9 tickets sold per person in 2011, which is the lowest it's been in 10 years.
Right. And the nice thing is you're seeing older people going back to the movies more.
Yes. Well, people over 50.
Right. There's a little fading of people, of teenagers, but there are older people going back to the movies pretty strongly. So I think that's healthy. I think that's good. I mean, 50 is the new 30, frankly. I don't know why advertisers dismiss people over 49 when they look at television demos. So there's no reason, you know, your money's as good as a teenager's. So, hey, if my mom's going to the movies, her money's great. So the best exotic Marigold hotel could make a lot of money for everybody. But you do want people to go to the movies. You want them to go consistently. But if you can maintain around 4 tickets per person in North America and you spread it out a little bit more so you're not so dependent on teenagers going to see movies 8 or 10 times, I think long term, that's probably a little bit healthier.
Well, you know, I would imagine that there are some people at studios saying, no, we like to target just one group. It makes it so much easier. We don't have to have an expert for people over 50. We don't have to have a market.
4 quadrants, baby. 4 quadrants. That's where it's at.
Right. Exactly. The 4 Qs. That's right. Exactly.
I mean, that's what they should be focusing on making. You don't want every movie to appeal to everybody, but there are movies that you do. And there should be movies also for seniors, for people over 50, and for teenagers. And, you know, you don't want to have every movie geared towards one quadrant, just teenagers. That's a bad idea. It's bad for the industry.
Well, you know, somebody who made movies that were geared mostly towards, well, families or young children was the animator Glenn Keane, who left Disney last week after 37 years.
Yes, he sort of quit, really.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I put the story in the lineup is really only because I worked with Glenn Keane at Disney in the early 90s, because he was one of those animators that was kind of...
He was key. He was a big figure in the renaissance of Disney.
That's right. I mean, he animated Ariel. He animated Beast and Beauty and the Beast. He animated Aladdin. He even animated Rapunzel and Tangled.
And Tarzan.
And Tarzan, yeah, and Pocahontas. So, you know, he along with Andreas Deja were two of the animators that I worked with, because they were the artists that Jeffrey Katzenberg would continuously roll out to meet, you know, either on the red carpet or meet the press. And so
they were the face of the Disney animators, kind of like Stan and Ollie were the face of the earlier generation.
Yeah, Ollie Johnson, I would imagine, is who you're referring to there.
Yeah, what did you do for Disney? I forget.
I was in their marketing department on the East Coast.
Do you know my friend Joe Smith? He was in Disney for years as well. He's at the Mohegan Sun.
I possibly. Actually, you know who I worked with when I was at Disney?
No.
Was a guy, he was the assistant to the head of, I think it was publicity or promotions on the East Coast. He was the East Coast head of Disney's motion picture promotions. And he was this young guy who kept saying, oh, I want to be a composer.
What's his name?
I want to be a composer. And he said,
Alan Menken.
No. Although Alan Menken was, of course, doing Beauty and the Beast and other films at the time. No, his name was Michael Giacchino.
Oh, he's a terrific composer.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so Glenn Keane has left the company sort of in disgust in a way. He was sort of pushed aside gently little by little to where, you know, he was working on Tangle, which at the time was called Rapunzel. And he's been a pretty strong innovator. He came up with this sort of deep focus technique for Tarzan, which was a massive hit. And why they didn't make a sequel, I still don't understand. It was a terrific action film. And what movie better suited to sequels? But anyway, he came up with this deep focus technique that made Tarzan feel a little 3D-ish. It was just very fresh and good. He was innovative in a lot of other ways. And in Rapunzel, the story of Rapunzel that they were telling, he was working on this incredibly rich boundary-pushing technique that was going to make Rapunzel look like a Renaissance painting. I don't know anything about it. I haven't seen any rushes, but people said it looked amazing. But that project obviously was stalled quite a bit. The Pixar people came in. They took over Disney. They reworked Rapunzel from the bottom up and turned it into Tangled. And it was a solid, strong success story. But he was sort of pushed aside as far as being in charge of that project and directing it. He had no projects in the works. He was sort of sitting there a little bit adrift. And he's decided to move on and try to go somewhere where people are looking for him. You know, people want him to work more.
Yeah, I mean, he's 57 years old. More than likely, he's going to wind up somewhere else. And I wouldn't be surprised if one day he wound up back at Disney on one project or another. But yeah, I think the fact that he lost Tangled, that John Lasseter, who he worked with, I think it was in the 70s or 80s. Yeah, in the 80s, he collaborated with John Lasseter on this short film that was being done to experiment with some technology. And Keane was kind of, you know, pushed aside by Lasseter when he came in after Disney acquired Pixar. And I think this was just kind of it for him. He was done. You know, they also lost Andreas Deja, who animated Lilo and Stitch and Scar from The Lion King. And they lost another guy, Chris Sanders, who went to DreamWorks and wound up making How to Train Your Dragon. So they're losing
a big success story.
Yeah. And actually, there were two animators. It was Dean DeBlois. I can't pronounce his last.
DeBlois, maybe.
And Chris Sanders, who did that How to Train Your Dragon. But yeah, it doesn't seem like the playlist had an interesting statement about how everybody seems to think that everything over at Pixar is like, you know, fairy dust and gumdrops. But there's actually some kind of disenfranchisement going on there.
Well, I don't think it's anything unusual. Disney was adrift. They were not making successful movies. The Pixar people were making one classic and massively successful film after another. And Disney took over Pixar, but creatively, Pixar took over Disney. So the old guard at Disney, who had done good work in the past, but had been quite adrift for a while, Forbidden Planet and all these, not Forbidden Planet, but Treasure Planet and all these other movies that did not work and were not making a lot of money, they got shunted aside a little bit. The Pixar people took over. It's not it's only natural that the new people come in with their own people and their own things, and these people sort of fell by the wayside. It's a shame to lose great talent. Hopefully they're going to other places where they're needed and wanted and can be in charge. I don't think it's evil or terrible machinations, and I certainly don't think it's a brain drain or that Disney is losing, you know, its core artists, because the Pixar people are there and they're flourishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always likened the decline of Disney animation in the mid to late 90s was due to the fact that Katzenberg was out in the early 90s, and it took like 3 to 4 years to make those movies. And so after Aladdin and after The Lion King, those were the movies.
And Tarzan.
Those were all movies he was involved with. And then after that, he was gone. So all of those movies kind of lost their I don't want to say leader, because of course they had directors, but they lost this chairman that really cared about them.
Yeah. So it's a sad news. I mean, but he was only 20 when he started working at Disney. So he's only 57, even though he's worked there for 37 years. He's got a lot of life left in him, and I'm sure he'll be doing some great work elsewhere, because I'm a huge fan of his work.
Yeah, I never knew, though, that he was the son of Bill Keane, the creator of the Family Circus cartoon.
I did not know that either. Yeah. I guess he, as a child, he probably wandered over his backyard in a crazy diagram-like way.
No.
I wanted to mention one other little thing in our stats about movies. Tangled was created in 3D. I don't know if his original vision involved 3D, but there was a good stat about 3D films. Is 3D a fad? We saw charts involved in all that release of end of year information that 3D movies made roughly $300 million in 2008 when it was sort of coming back into its, you know, four. Then it made $1.2 billion in 2009. Then it made $2.2 billion in 2010. And those were obviously the years when Avatar was released, in December of 2009 into 2010. And now it's dropped 20% in 2011 pretty hard, from $2.2 billion to $1.8 billion. So people are starting to strongly and clearly reject 3D. Whether it'll find a level of 1.5, 1.8 billion, or whether it will continue to drop, as I hope, I think people will continue to walk away from 3D because it's too expensive and not worth it most of the time. That'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on.
Well, you say it's a pretty clear statement, but I look at this and go, well, most of Avatar's money came in 2010. So the fact that it made 3D movies made $2.2 billion in 2010 and then declined by $400 million in 2011. That $400 million very well could have been going mostly to Avatar.
That's true. In 2010, a lot of the money went to Avatar. So you're saying there was healthy business done for all the other movies that remained. And so that, in fact, if you took out Avatar, the biggest success, you'd see pretty good growth in 2011. I would argue that I think the successes were clearly earlier in the year. And as the year progressed, we saw lower and lower and lower grosses, just like you see in The Hunger Games, that IMAX movies was not a big draw for The Hunger Games. I think 3D, month by month, you can see the chart where people go, you know what? I don't need to see this in 3D. I don't need to see that in 3D. And I think that's going to continue in 2012.
Well, really, what's hidden in these numbers, this $2.2 billion in 2010 down to $1.8 billion in 2011, down 20%, is that between 2010 and 2011, there were more 3D-capable movie theaters.
There were more movies released, more 3D movies, more theaters. So again, more movies making less money.
I think you're saying something I've been saying for a long time.
Well, speaking of making less money, that takes us to theater, where there are a couple shows on Broadway that I predicted would be off Broadway by now. Not meaning they'd be moved off Broadway, but they'd be gone.
And yet Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, is still playing.
The one I predicted.
Oh, I thought it was, okay. I thought maybe
It was Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Sister Act, and Godspell. Godspell I actually thought might hold on a little bit. But Priscilla and Sister Act are still on Broadway, and the question is, why?
Well, I could answer that question if only I were an expert in Broadway theater. But let me call somebody up who is. Hold on. Michael, do you have your cell phone with you? I've got to call you up.
Oh, no, I'm already here.
Oh, okay. Well, can you please tell me why Sister Act, which was and is based on a movie starring Whoopi Goldberg from the early 90s, which was a movie I worked on at Disney, I might add. Why is this now a Broadway hit?
Well, there are a couple shows we're going to look at. And the New York Times did a great story, we'll link to it in our show notes, talking about these shows and why are they still running, even though their grosses are pretty darn low. And you won't be surprised to find out there are multiple reasons for each show. One reason is that the theaters are just not ready for a new tenant. Priscilla and Sister Act, they've got like less than 40% of their potential gross, which is really low.
Anything so basically, they're playing to more than half-empty theaters.
Right. The theaters are 60% empty. You might go on Friday or Saturday night and find, you know, they're pretty full, but you go on a Tuesday night, you're going to have seriously empty houses, and you do not want to see empty seats. Anything less than 50% of your potential gross is a problem.
So now if you're a theater owner, right, has a theater and you've got Sister Act there and you don't have anybody to come in, do you then turn to the producers of Sister Act and say, hey, look, I'm going to lower the rent so that you can stay here for a while?
Well, the theater has a clause. It's called the, what is that called? It's called the drop dead clause, something like that. What is
Go
it called?
Away.
It's called the, it's a clause in the contract that says once a show grosses lower than this amount for 1 week or 2 or 3 weeks in a row or 2 or 3 weeks non-consecutively, whatever it might be, once it falls below this certain mark, we have the right to pull the plug. Doesn't mean they will pull the plug, but the theater can say, you got to leave, you're done. We're closing you down. In this case, the show is not making enough money week to week, and it's called a stop clause. I finally found it. So theaters do have that stop clause, so they can pull the plug if they want to. And these shows have probably hit their stop clause a couple of times in their runs and given the theater owners a chance to pull the plug, but they didn't. Why? Well, in Priscilla's case, it's just that they're not ready for a new show yet. They've got their eye, for example, the theater owners that are booking Priscilla, they have their eye on Annie, the revival of the hit musical, which is opening in the fall. Annie has not committed to a house yet, and they're lobbying to try to get Annie to come into their house. So if they've got Annie coming in, you know, October, I'm making the dates up, but it's something like September, October, November, I don't know. They want Annie, and they expect that to be a long-running hit for 5 years. Well, why would they want to pull the plug on Priscilla, you know, back in March? Their theater would be dead for 8 months or 6 months or 5 months. Why not let Priscilla trundle along for a few more months, keep the lights on, keep your staff working, keep everybody busy? So that's probably the reason why they haven't asked Priscilla to take a hike yet.
Well, and they're waiting for Rosie O'Donnell to be free so that she can star as Miss Hannigan in Annie.
That's right. Sister Act is a different case. In that case, Sister Act is being backed by this billionaire, this Dutch billionaire, Joep van der Ende. He's a billionaire, which means if he wants to.
Wait, is that a billionaire with a B? Or
that is with a B.
Is it a
that
capital B?
If he wants to, he could make very expensive Broadway musicals for like $20, $30, $40 million, do one a year for 20 years, and still have plenty of money left over. So this is a man with deep, deep pockets. and they want to make him happy. And he is launching Sister Act all over the world. He opened in London. It didn't do great. He opened in New York. It didn't do great. Now he's opening it all over the world, touring it, taking it to other countries. And he knows the value of the show is greater while it's on Broadway and if it has a nice long Broadway run. And the theater owners know this guy's going to be making a lot of more shows down the road and he's got a lot of money. We don't want to, you know, tick him off.
So you're saying it's kind of like, well, we're going to do a theatrical release, even though we may break even. In fact, we might lose a little bit of money, but we're doing that so that we can be on the top shelf at Walmart and Best Buy because they want to see a theatrical release.
Right. Or it's like you want George Clooney to make your new superhero franchise. So you release a small independent film to make nice.
Right.
So it's not going to make a lot of money, but you keep it out there just to make him happy. Or you do an Oscar campaign for a director because you want them to make their next movie. It's that sort of thing. You're scratching his back to make him happy.
Well, I know somebody that should talk to this. Joep van der Ende.
Uh-huh.
Julie Taymor.
That's right. So Sister Act is there. It's done okay week to week sometimes. Shows are probably a lot more expensive than I realized. They probably have running costs of about $500,000, $600,000 a week, depending on how big the show is and how big the stars are. This show did not have a lot of big stars, but they're bringing in a new one, Raven Simone, who, if you have kids, probably knows her from her TV shows. And she's going to take over the lead role in Sister Act, and that might goose attendance down the road. And they'll probably make a decision after she opens up in it whether or not to keep it going. And they're also probably keeping their eye on other shows.
Now, I see you have the Spider-Man watch. I don't know if this is a new segment, but apparently
it's probably an old segment, I think.
Yeah, well, they're running at $1 million per week, the highest on Broadway.
No, that's the running cost, we think. Yeah.
Yeah.
We think that's been reported. We don't really know that, but it seems to be sort of semi-confirmed by this dude. That's a massive amount of money. But they've never dropped below $1 million a week, which means every week they've at least broken even. So this show, there's no reason to think it won't run for a long, long time. As long as it's, you know, making more money than it costs, you know, that's a massive big house. It's hard to fill, hard to find the right show. And so I think everybody's happy. And at times during the winter, it was down to $1.2 million a week, which is pretty low. And it's well down from its potential. But it's making $200,000 a week, which is what a lot of shows make. It's chipping away at the cost of the show. And now it's back up to $1.5 billion. Billion? No, my God, that would be amazing. $1.5 million a week. So it's, you know, if it can net $500,000 a week, well, you know what? That's serious money. In a year, you've made $26 million and you've chipped away at that massive budgetary cost. So that show is going to chug along. Then you've got something like Godspell, which is in a small house. It's the perfect house for this show. It's never done that well. It has Jesus Christ Superstar, a revival coming, but the buzz is pretty bad on that. It opened in pretty mixed reviews. So Godspell might even weather that storm. They're bringing in a new star. Hunter Parrish, the TV star from Weeds, is leaving the show to go back to work, and they're bringing in Corbin Blue, who people know from High School Musical, to be the new figure of Jesus on that show. So it's a very, very low running cost as compared to Spider-Man. It probably costs $300,000, if not less, a week. There are no stars in it, and it has a very small rock band, not a big orchestra. So tiny, tiny run, and no sets.
And you're talking about Godspell now.
Yeah, Godspell.
Okay, because you very easily could be talking about Jesus Christ Superstar.
Jesus Christ Superstar does not have a big name in the cast
at all.
I don't know what its I don't know what its sets are like. I don't know that it's
bare bones.
I can tell
you they're basically scaffolding. That's about it.
Well, scaffolding can be expensive. I mean, Ragtime had scaffolding, but it can be elaborate and expensive. There can be lights and effects and things going on. I mean, he's raised up on a giant cross. He's lowered. He's tortured. I don't know what
we've got to bring him back to life. You know,
Godspell has no set. It is a stage. There's like a little thing you open up and there's a little pool where they baptize people in. It's very, very low tech. That's the whole point of the show. I don't think Jesus Christ is quite that low tech, but I am seeing it Tuesday night. So that's one of the big new shows coming up.
As is Newsies. And it looks here that Newsies is sold out.
Newsies is doing great. It's selling all its tickets. It's not charging a ton of money for them yet, but it made like $700,000, $800,000 its first week of previews. Evita is doing great.
Evita, yet another show based on a movie.
No, it's not. It was originally a Broadway musical, and it's coming from London, where it was a big success. Its first week, it only had 6 performances, and it still joined the Million Dollar Club, the list of shows that grossed more than $1 million a week. So it's going to be doing really well. It joins Wicked, The Lion King, Spider-Man, and The Book of Mormon. It's virtually sold out. So that looks like a really strong hit.
So you'd
and
say that's once, kind of a big deal then?
I would, just like Once, which is a charming, charming musical. If you come to New York, please buy your tickets and go see Once. It's a delightful show.
That show got rave reviews here in Los Angeles, and it hasn't even opened in Los Angeles.
So it's a big deal even in LA.
Well, then if that's the case, we should probably move along into Big Deal Hour or Big Whoop, which is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, just as we predicted, the hit AMC series The Walking Dead is bigger than ever. A genuine phenomenon, the season 2 finale hit 9 million viewers, with millions more catching the repeat and online chances to watch the show. That's 50% higher than the season 1 finale. It also beat its own record for a basic cable show. It snagged viewers in all the key demos. The entire season averaged 6.9 million viewers, which is a 32% increase over the first season. I mean, these are all just all these numbers piling up. The show is such a big hit, they ran clever promos for Mad Men that repurposed clips from the 60s set drama to play off the zombie apocalypse of Walking Dead and literally said, "Hey, Walking Dead fans, watch this show." So the show's key showrunner, Frank Darabont, was pushed out of the way at the beginning of the season, but the series continues to flourish anyway. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. I mean, if this show was on a major network, it would be in the top 15 of all shows in the country. That's how big a hit it is, even though it's on basic cable. I think creatively, it was a very strong season. I really like it. It ended dramatically. Season 3 is going to be set in the prison. Everybody who's read the books knows about this prison. It's very exciting. And it was a lot of fun. And I think emotionally and creatively and ratings-wise, it's a fun show. My friend Aaron hates it, thinks it's terrible. And it's very violent, because we're going to be talking to a guy who deals with the MPAA later. If they were rating this show for theaters, it would be at least a PG-13.
Definitely,
It's definitely a violent show. It's not for the little kids, but it's a lot of fun.
I'm just going to make a big note here to myself to actually watch the 24 episodes I have on TiVo of The Walking Dead. Now, speaking of AMC, their critical darling Mad Men also continues to grow. It premiered last night. It was at the fourth or the fifth season. I don't even know anymore. Fifth season. 18-month break they took. And the show returned with a record-breaking 3.5 million viewers. So that should tell you the difference between, like, you know, Walking Dead at 9 million and Mad Men at 3.5 million viewers. And that's a hefty jump over the 2.9 million viewers who watched the season 4 premiere. They also set records, Mad Men that is, in key demos. And you can bet the audience that watches this series is very well-heeled and highly educated. The same sort of audience that made low-rated shows like St. Elsewhere profitable for major networks in the past. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It does put it in context. It shows you, hey, this was never a massive commercial hit. It's a critical darling. It did put AMC on the map. It wins the Emmys. It's not watched by a lot of people, but it's still growing. So that's great news for them and for everybody involved. I felt the show really lost its way in the third and fourth season creatively. It was a pretty good season opener. I found it pretty satisfying, probably better than some in the last few years. Still a few problems. The race stuff was handled kind of clumsily. But it was pretty satisfying, and I don't know why, but they insist that Don Draper must be married to a woman who cannot act. I don't know why. They're very beautiful, but they can't act. January Jones couldn't act, and this woman couldn't act, but God bless them. So I'm looking forward to the rest of the season.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I found it amazing, all of this publicity and billboards and on the front page of magazine, 3.5 million people watch it.
What I'd love to know is its worldwide sales. There was an item about Games of Thrones. And they're launching that show very successfully in Germany by showing a massive marathon weekend. And their explanation was, you know, people's viewing habits have changed a lot because of DVDs and how they want to consume a show. And we have season 2 coming. And to introduce the show to Germany, they did a long weekend marathon of all 10 episodes or whatever there are of the HBO series Game of Thrones. And it was very successful. It did a lot better than other HBO shows, which they've had trouble launching. Dexter didn't do well. That's a Showtime series. And other shows have not translated well to Germany for some reason. But this was a good success and has set them up for season 2. And reminds you that the worldwide market for shows like Game of Thrones and Mad Men and Walking Dead is huge. And we don't really get good numbers to know how many countries it's playing in, how much money they're making, how well they're doing. That's sort of an arcane world that we don't get to glimpse very often.
No, because it's all, you know, due to rights and who owns the rights. And so, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, how much money does...
Ultimately, there's somebody who created the show and they're making money off the show. And they're, you know, how many countries is it playing? What sort of ratings are it doing? We get a good idea now of worldwide box office. I'd love to get a better sense of how many countries and how well financially Mad Men is doing, because that would explain to you why it could only have 3 million viewers and it'd be such a valuable property for AMC and why they treat it like the world-class, you know, event that it is.
Well, I think in part, it's, you know, it is the reason that The Walking Dead and Hell on Wheels and all of these shows have gone to AMC. That was their first breakout, you know, original programming, and it did it phenomenally well and was critically acclaimed, and everybody loved it. And so other shows and other show creators turned to AMC.
Yeah, that's a different issue. But yeah, no, once you went, yeah, the show put them on the map, Mad Men, and that brought in Breaking Bad and The Walking Dead and all the rest. But as far as continuing to pump a lot of money into a show that has pretty modest ratings, good ratings compared to what AMC used to get, and now what they're actually getting and the money they're spending, it makes sense because they're building up a franchise that's very valuable in terms of DVD sales and rerun sales and worldwide market, which matters quite a bit.
Well, many of my friends who will either produce cable shows or work at cable networks say, if you can get a show that gets 500,000 people to tune in, you're a hit. And these are
It depends on the channel. Wouldn't be a hit on NBC.
And these are not, yeah, that's correct. And that's where I was headed. These are not like the big CNNs, you know, these are, you know, Spike TV. If you can get a show, or, you know, the Food Network, you get 500,000 viewers on the Food Network tuning into your show, that's a hit.
It depends on your lead-in. If your lead-in is 4 million viewers and you get 500,000 viewers, it's not a hit. It's all context is all.
Speaking of things that are not a hit, remember the legendary trade paper Variety? Remember
that? It's not BAFO anymore.
Yeah, that's true. It's up for sale, in fact. But who would really want to buy it? I mean, there's declining sales, fewer ads, more competition. Is it possible that no one would see the value in keeping the name Variety active or alive? Or at the very least, keep it online? Reed Business Information, which owns Variety, is dumping all of its magazines now, and they're focusing on data-driven products, not editorial products. They're kind of selling them off one by one, starting here in the U.S. They tried to sell the entire bundle of magazines here in the U.S. in 2008, but they couldn't get a good price, so they took it off the market. Now they're unloading them one by one. They waited now, get this, they waited until after the Oscar season and the cash inflow of four-year considerations ads were over before announcing this sale. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal in the sense of the end of an era. It's a big whoop in the sense that Variety is not the player that it used to be. It's very sad. Friends and I were joking, my IRA members, who we were there at the weekend in Mohegan Sun, we were joking, hey, we should buy Variety, to which I said, why? You're not going to make any money on it. I can't imagine how you would launch that or relaunch that to make money. It could be a valuable name for some major media conglomerate as a standalone or a small company. I don't think it could work anymore.
I liked Nikki Fink's, well, I didn't like it necessarily, but Nikki Fink kind of used this as a moment to pat herself on the back. She said, and she's, of course, the editor of Deadline Hollywood, and she wrote, Variety for sale, and then in parentheses, because it can't compete with Deadline Hollywood.
Nothing like tooting your own horn. She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, and the whole article was not only about the sale, but also about how great Deadline was. Speaking of things that are great, Apple can really pat itself on the back. The new iPad is a huge success. It may not be officially named, by the way, the iPad 3. It's called the new iPad, but there is definitely, the number 3 is definitely its lucky number. They've sold 3 million tablets in the first 3 days. In comparison, the first iPad sold 300,000 tablets in the first day, and the second one sold a reported 400,000 to 1 million in its first weekend.
So they've gone from 300,000 to maybe 1 million to 3 million in the first weekend.
That's right. The recent, and kind of follow me on this. The recent iPhone, the 4S, sold 4 million in its first weekend. iPad 3 sold 3 million units, and the iPhone 4S sold 4 million units in its first weekend. You see where I'm going here? Maybe they should name the next iPad the iPad 10. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. They dominate the tablet market. They've got Amazon Kindle Fire as somewhat of a competitor, and other people are making tablets. You know, this is a huge growth area for Apple. They created a whole new electronic product, and it's working tremendously well.
YouTube has its standards and practices, and Madonna just crossed them. Her latest music video, which is cleverly titled Girl Gone Wild, get it? Girl Gone Wild. Yeah, well, how do you get it? Do you watch that kind of material?
All the time.
Well,
at least in TV commercials late at night.
That's true. And, my problem is that late at night, all those commercials look so blurry. Anyway.
Madonna says, don't interrupt my story.
Okay, well, Madonna's Girl Gone Wild, she cleverly titled it that, and it's a spin on the softcore porn videos. She has been restricted to 18 and over on the YouTube video site. However, despite being set aside for adults only, YouTube also requested some edits involving nudity and implied masturbation. Madonna's people immediately called it censorship and compared this to MTV's edits on the raunchy Justify My Love video way back in the early 90s, but are apparently ready to comply. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. The video will be available on some compilation. I'm sure it's probably on her website. YouTube has to have standards just like everyone else. And their Are You 18 thing is very soft as far as restrictiveness. So I can understand why they'd still want to make sure their content is not, you know, pornographic. They don't have adult films on YouTube, as far as I know. And I can understand why they want to have certain standards for their website. But it just really goes to show that YouTube is the new MTV. That's where people go to look at music videos.
Yeah, I mean, if I were MTV, I'd be a little kind of sad because I'd look at this. Well, I guess if I were MTV, I would know what I was doing, hopefully, and I would either not be sad by this or really disappointed because that should be us they're talking about.
We should be the ones censoring Madonna.
Yeah, well, you know what I mean. They should be writing about MTV, not YouTube.
If it's Jersey Shore.
Right, that's true. And I'd love to censor that right off the air. Streamed any good movies lately, Michael?
No, I haven't.
Well, that may become the new normal in 2012. One firm is predicting the number of movies watched by consumers online will actually surpass the number of movies that we all watch on DVD for the first time this year. And this is IHS Screen Digest. They're saying people will spend $1.7 billion to stream and download movies and more than $11 billion to buy and rent them on DVD and Blu-ray. Despite dwarfing online in revenue, people will see far fewer movies on those little shiny discs. Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu account for the lion's share of online viewing at 94%. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal when it happens. I think they're comparing apples to oranges, though. In my new role as fact checker of the world, like I did for The Hollywood Reporter, they're comparing, you know, rentals on one side to rentals and sort of some sales in a new market to rentals and sales in another market. It doesn't quite work. If you compared video rental online, the streaming, to video rental on DVD, I think the amount of money spent will be a lot closer. When you throw in DVD sales, which is very different, that really throws it off. If you took out the $7 or $8 billion people spend on DVD sales, well, suddenly the $1.7 billion spent to stream and download movies doesn't seem so out of whack.
So what you're saying is that people don't buy movies when they're digital; they buy them on DVD.
They do, but that's buying something is very different from renting it. They should have broken out their numbers. They should have compared online renting to DVD renting. But you can't really do that because people subscribe to movies. So when you're subscribing to Netflix and you spend $8, $9 a month, how do you break it down per movie? You know, it's a little hard to compare. But overall, they spent whatever $1 billion renting online. You should compare that to renting DVDs physically. And then you compare buying movies online to buying movies, you know, physically. That's what you should be comparing, not this conglomeration of numbers. Because I don't think they're so out of whack. Their implication of their article was that people are seeing a lot more movies, but they do it for a lot less money online.
That's right. That's really the important bit here is that...
That's what they wanted to emphasize. But yeah. I think they're throwing it out of whack by comparing DVD sales, which are massive, to DVD rentals, which are much lower.
Well, how about something a little bit lighter then? Gwyneth Paltrow, you know her. She's this, you know, she's done a few movies.
The woman on Glee.
Yes, that's right. Well, she says she wrote her own cookbook, thank you very much. Now, the New York Times, well, they did a recent piece on cookbook ghostwriters, a not surprising spin detailing the writers who do all the heavy lifting on cookbooks, just like other writers ghostwrite memoirs. And now in a caption in this story, it listed Julia Tertian as a ghostwriter on Paltrow's My Father's Daughter.
Paltrow, it's a cookbook that she put out.
That's right. Yeah. Paltrow used Twitter to deny she had any ghostwriter on the book, which has simple recipes and there's some personal family anecdotes in there. Paltrow has a website and a newsletter called Goop. You ever swing by that, Michael?
I looked by it to prepare for the show, but I've never been there.
Okay, well, it regularly provides food and lifestyle tidbits. On the other hand, Paltrow does acknowledge Tertian's involvement by saying in the book, in the acknowledgments, this is a quote, she could not have written this book without the tireless, artful assistance of Julia Tertian, who stood over my shoulder at the stove and chopping block for the better part of a year, bringing a method to my freestyling madness. The Times article, by the way, is still on the website with the caption included, though an apparent reference to a new project that Gwyneth Paltrow may be writing, that's gone.
With Tertian,
that's gone. And there is not a correction mentioned at all. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It's interesting. I'd never thought about it. But in fact, a lot of these celebrity cookbooks, even the big name chefs, they put out such a volume of cookbooks that they don't do all the work themselves. They've got assistants and ghostwriters creating stuff. And this article ranged the whole gamut from a chef who said, hey, put something in it about poultry. You know, like, yeah, there got to be something about poultry in that book. Put it in there. to others who are very deeply involved in the copy of their articles or even deeply involved in the creating of the recipes. So there's a whole range of, you know, involvement depending on the person. Since there's no correction, I don't know what the deal is. Clearly, this woman was involved in helping the cookbook come to life, but, you know, it has a lot of personal anecdotes. And Gwyneth Paltrow's there saying, hey, I wrote it. So, you know, got to take her at her word till they prove something else.
Yeah, it takes sometimes years to write a cookbook if you're not doing it this way.
Well, no, you don't need ghostwriter for the cop. I mean, it depends what you mean by ghostwriter. Are you talking about somebody who creates the recipes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Gwyneth Paltrow's book has a lot of memoir and anecdote in it.
Okay.
It's stories. And she's saying, I wrote the stories, first of all. So don't think that this woman wrote the stories. I do a blog. I have a website. I write stuff all the time. I created these recipes. They were handed down from my father. She says this woman helped her refine and work with it. And that's the implication. But she's saying when it came down to the actual copy, I wrote the copy, especially the anecdotes. That's very different from another cookbook that might just have 800 recipes in it. And you might say that the assistant created all the recipes. You know, that's just very different issues. And without knowing, I just take her at her word.
Well, Michael, remember how we said renewing a TV series the day after it premieres, or even sometimes before it premieres, was like the latest thing to show confidence in a show? It's kind of the new black in television.
I do.
Well, guess what? Stars is now raising the bar. Its new period drama, Magic City, about Miami during the go-go days of the 1950s, has just been renewed for a second season, almost a month before the first season even debuts. The show will premiere April 6th, knowing that another 10 episodes for season 2 have already been ordered. And this is a quote from Chris Albrecht, the Starz CEO. He says, Magic City is beautifully written, superbly acted, and visually stunning series. And we feel the quality of the work accomplished deserves a second season. It has already been sold in more than 70 territories worldwide and represents the kind of premium entertainment the Starz brand is seeking to create. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It does show the raising stakes and how you want to, you know, stake a show as a really big property by saying, hey, we're going to do 2 seasons. I mean, we had that with Tyler Perry. His sitcoms, once they have a debut test episode, they get 100 episode renewal. You know, they say, look, we're going to make 100 episodes of this show, House of Pain, or 100 episodes of that show. We're going to commit to it right now because you can do it all together at once, make it cheaper, make it focused, and get it done there. We know we're going to have enough for syndication. In this case, you have Starz saying, this is our big property. Spartacus has been big. We have other shows that are big. And this one, we believe, is a big property. And they're sort of staking their claim by committing to 2 seasons. On the other hand, 2 seasons is 20 episodes.
That's right.
That's kind of what a major network does for 1 season. So you got to put it all in perspective. It's a big financial commitment, but they've seen 10 episodes. They like what they see. They're willing to move forward. They've sent out a lavish preview package, which I have not watched yet. But again, we've talked about worldwide markets for television. It's been sold in more than 70 territories. There you go. They've got a lot of people waiting for this show. They've had a lot of success selling it. So that tells you again that that worldwide market can drive a TV series and make a basic cable show be very profitable.
The Discovery Network is questioning the report of an analyst that says Oprah Winfrey's cable channel, OWN, is set to lose more than $140 million in 2012.
I could lose $140 million.
Well, the prediction came, you know, we talked about this last week, days after OWN announced it was firing or laying off, as it's known in the industry, 20% of the staff and canceling their flagship non-Oprah show, which is what we talked about last week. They canceled Rosie O'Donnell. Yeah. And reshuffling the top executive lineup again. Still, Discover is fighting back at the perception that OWN is sinking. And this is a quote. They say, the report is riddled with inaccuracies and bad information. And this is a quote from Discovery Senior Executive Vice President David Levy to the Los Angeles Times. He says, the venture is on more solid ground with more business momentum than ever before. They pointed to 2013 when cable channels start to pay fees to carry OWN, creating a significant cash flow for the first time. And I guess that would be cable operators would be paying. Big deal or big whoop?
I say it's a big whoop because they provide no information. They say, oh, it's riddled with inaccuracies. Well, I didn't see any inaccuracies that they pointed out, so I'd like to know what those inaccuracies were.
So if it's accurate, is it a big deal if it's accurate?
You mean the initial report?
Yes.
Well, sure. If it's going to lose $140 million this year, that's accurate. I also want to know all the cable operators that are signed on to OWN, do they have to pay a fee in 2013, or can they say we don't want to carry the channel anymore?
They could say they don't want to carry the channel anymore, I believe, although there might be maybe contractual issues.
Right, it depends on the contract, but that's another issue. They're saying, hey, those people are going to start paying us in 2013. Maybe in 2013, those people are going to say, you know what, we don't need your channel anymore because it's not making any money. Nobody's watching it. So, you know, if you're going to say someone has delivered a report with inaccuracies, you have to detail what they are. Give us your numbers. Tell us what the deal is. When you don't, we can't really trust you or take you at your word. You know, if you don't back it up with figures, we don't believe you.
Well, here's a solid number for you. Mark Burnett, the producer behind Survivor and The Apprentice, he has settled a lawsuit with his former partner to the tune of, and here's this serious number, a reported $70 million. Imagine how much money that guy's making, that $70 million is this settlement. Well, it implies, by the way, here you go, here's another serious number, that Burnett has earned some $700 million over the past decade on his smash hit reality shows. The bitter case between the former partners has been dragging through the courts for years, but as often happens in Hollywood, people with a genuine case get a settlement before it ever goes before a jury, and the press gets a chance to look at the books of all the major players and all that paperwork, that juicy paperwork. Is the settlement a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It only matters to them. But boy, oh boy, that's a lot of money. I mean, Survivor and The Apprentice have been two massive franchises for, you know, television, CBS and NBC. The Apprentice obviously is on the downswing, but it's also been copied all over the world. Again, boy, this is the theme of the week. And Survivor, same thing, which was itself a copy, I believe, of a show done overseas first. I forget, was
that's
it
right.
The Netherlands
yes.
or something?
No, it was, I think, in the UK. I don't know.
No, the UK was not the first one. UK did the Big Brother first.
Oh, okay. That's what it is.
I believe it was a Scandinavian country, but I could be wrong. I often am. But $70 million, meaning that Burnett's company or whatever has pulled in $700 million? Wow.
George Orwell's novel, 1984, is a classic text, not because it predicted the future, but because it described the present, namely life in totalitarian states like the Soviet Union. It described it in vividly dramatic and exaggerated form. Much of Orwell's details, from TV screens that can never be turned off and which transmit propaganda to doublespeak, are all too real today in North Korea and all over the world. And yet, a great film or TV adaptation has never been made, except a great television commercial was made by...
a spinoff by Apple, yeah.
Yeah. Now, Ron Howard's Imagine and one other company, they're teaming up to secure the rights from the Orwell estate, prodded along somehow and for some reason, I have no idea why, by the artist Shepard Fairey, the graffiti artist. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a movie project, as Karen would say. She's not here, but I can hear her sitting on my shoulder telling me, big whoop, director makes movie. But Shepard Fairey, I wish I knew how he got involved in this and why and how. I mean, obviously he'd make the poster for the movie, but I mean, how is he a player in this? Has he ever made another movie? I don't know what's going on there, but I'm intrigued.
NBC has renewed the musical drama Smash for a second season. And of course they did. It's their number one drama in total viewers and number one in the coveted 18 to 49 demo. So it's a no-brainer. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It's good for the show. But again, you got to put it in context. That's what I want to say. There was another news article saying that the showrunner, the creator of Smash, Teresa Rebeck, is gone.
That's right.
So they renewed it for a second season, but they said, we're renewing it, but it sucks.
And the female lead on the show, Deborah Messing, is supposedly, you know, playing Rebeck.
Right. Well, yeah, it's inspired somewhat by her, you know, but yeah, so they've fired the creator and the executive producer and the showrunner, but they've renewed the show for a second season. It has a lot of viewers, except it doesn't, because it follows NBC's only big hit that's not football, and that's The Voice, which is like last week or the week before was the number three show in the country. Smash follows that, so it's NBC's top-rated drama just because it has nothing else in the game. In fact, Smash is still losing over 50% of The Voice audience. So those are terrible numbers. So I was wondering, as soon as they announced this, but where will it play? Are they going to keep it in front of The Voice? It makes a natural fit philosophically, but it hasn't done the job. They need to move it to another night and see if it can fly on its own. They're obviously going to retool the show dramatically. It needs a lot of work. I frankly don't even know why creatively they would bring it back.
Because it's NBC.
Well, they have nothing. It's true, but this isn't nothing. This is still nothing. It's not a success by any way. There's a thing called a time slot hit. A show like Private Practice follows Grey's Anatomy, and it holds on to a good amount of the audience, and it works. Or like A Different World following The Cosby Show. Those are shows that were successful, I'm putting that in quotes, in the ratings, and they made money for everybody, and they ran for a number of years, but nobody thought they would exist on their own. If you moved it to another time slot, they thought those shows are not going to work, and they never did. And this show, I think, is not a time slot hit. It's a time slot flop. You know, it's just the NBC's bar is so low that they're keeping it back. But if you look at how it's doing compared to The Voice, this show is not a success.
Well, do you think that they'll give it an entire season?
I don't think they'll give it a half season renewal. I think they, in fact, they did give it a full season renewal. I mean, it doesn't work for, you know, five episodes. It's a one long storyline. So if you right. want to sell it on DVD or overseas, you've got to finish the season. So I think they'll, maybe they'll shorten the number of episodes, but I think they'll commit to whatever they want for that season.
Well, that kind of concludes, not only kind of concludes, it does conclude Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, this is definitely a story that not only has the entertainment industry buzzing, but certainly has newspapers writing about it. The MPAA rating system seems to have caused quite a stir. Now, we're going to be joined by Ethan Noble, who worked for Miramax and Dimension Films and more recently the Weinstein Company. And while there, he was submitting films to the MPAA for ratings. His company, Motion Picture Consulting, helps studios advocate for the ratings they want. He says there are flaws and inaccuracies in the system, and the company helps filmmakers overcome and avoid some obstacles during the ratings process. Now, Ethan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Now, when I told somebody that you were going to be joining us, they said, Motion Picture Consulting? What does a motion picture consultant do?
That's a really good question. I mean, I was with Harvey and Bob Weinstein, Weinstein Company Dimension, and Weinstein Company for probably about a decade or so, and then I left to kind of start my own company doing MPA ratings. And what I do essentially is work with independent filmmakers, producers, writers, and distributors to kind of get in early, work on their films, and help them navigate the process. Because it can be a little daunting and a little tricky, especially for a lot of the independent guys, knowing how to get a film rated and what tools you have to get the rating that you want.
Well, one would think that there isn't enough work as somebody who is helping filmmakers get their films rated. I mean, I guess last year the MPAA says that they had 758 movies submitted for ratings.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I've worked on probably about 400 or 500 over the last decade or so. So there's definitely a number of films out there, and they're pretty busy. I mean, they're booked up typically months in advance because, you know, almost every film, as you know, with the distribution and exhibition we have in place, almost always require a rating. So with all the movies out there, not to mention direct-to-video titles, there's a lot of work for them and a lot of work for us.
So, Ethan, if 700 plus movies are released in a year and only four in 2011 or 10 in 2010 are submitted for appeal, it sounds like the rating mm-hmm. system is working. But isn't it the case that a lot of movie studios sort of self-censor themselves and they know going in what they have to do in order to get the rating they want? And so they're, with your help and other people's help, making the decisions they need to, offering a rough cut that they know they can trim here and there to get a rating, we took this and that out, and so now we can get the PG-13. I mean, is that sort of part of the system? It may only have a few number of films being appealed, but they're affecting a lot more movies and a lot more creative decisions than we may see reflected in that number.
Oh, absolutely. I think, major studios especially have been submitting films for a long time, and they kind of know. I mean, the MPAA doesn't have necessarily a set of written guidelines that are too specific. I mean, they have the one rule in there about the expletives. You can only have, one or potentially two uses of one of the stronger expletives in a film, and it can't be used in sexual content. But other than that, they're pretty broad in what, ratings will be, you'll get for certain things in a film. And most of the major studios know that, and we obviously know that very well. After doing this for so long. So it's, most people that submit know going in. They know what rating it's going to be. There's a lot of times they submit a film and they know they're going to be able to trim it down and they want to kind of push the envelope a bit. But at the end of the day, they know where they're going to land. But then a lot of the smaller studios that submit things that don't submit all the time are either, very surprised at where their movie lands in the rating system. And then also some major studios, sometimes, you'll submit a film and know it's going to get a certain rating or believe it's going to get a certain rating. And for some reason, there's those films that hit that don't get the rating at all that's expected by both me or sometimes the major studios. And that's when the appeal process kind of kicks into play. And, usually I'll say 95% of the movies that I rate, I know exactly what it's going to be, and it works out exactly that way. But there's always sometimes a factor with the board that disagrees with what I feel is common sense, and most studios would feel is common sense. And I think a lot of the issue is that, you guys know the composition of the board. Should I go over how the MPAA is structured, or is that something that most of your listeners are familiar with?
Well, we may as well go over it, because I don't necessarily, okay. I think it's somewhat of an opaque organization, and I don't think a lot of people understand that what the MPAA does and how the ratings mm-hmm. work.
Okay. Just to start at the basic level, I mean, a filmmaker will make a film. We'll talk about independent. We'll make a film and, you know, go to sell it to a distributor. And the distributor wants a rating on it, typically. Sometimes the distributor will do it themselves. They have more control over the process. But say you're an independent filmmaker. You make a movie and you want to get it submitted. So you call them up. You say, I want to get a rating for the movie. You fill out an application, which they give you, which is a few pages about the film itself. And you pay a ratings fee. They schedule the film for you. You send the film to them. You know, usually, again, they're 3 or 4 months backed up typically, although there's ways to go ahead and get on a wait list if the space opens up. And if it's an urgent matter and your film comes out really soon, they're usually pretty flexible in that. So you submit the film, you send it to them, and it's watched by, 10, 12, 15, depending on the type of movie, the level of the film, people that are the board members. And then in each screening, there is a senior member who is actually a staff employee of the MPA that's been on for a while, where their sole job is to kind of put together all the comments of the board members. They fill out forms, they look at it, and they say, okay, we have this many PG-13s, this many Rs, for example. And then they call that independent filmmaker and they say, you know, the board watched your film. And we have, we don't give you the exact number, but they'll say the film, you know, is an R, and here's your rating descriptor for, you know, violence, sexual content, nudity, or whatever it may be. I mean, as a filmmaker, you say, okay, great, thank you. Or you go back to the drawing table and say, okay, we'd like to resubmit and make some changes. And, you know, typically they'll go over, all right, this scene's a little strong. What my company does is if they get to that point.
So the MPAA will actually come in and say, you can call them back and ask, well, why did it get an R?
Yes. Yeah, that's one thing that people seem to not get, and I'm not sure why that is. The MPAA is very... They'll communicate with you. Granted, they can't give you specifics because they can't, you know, they don't know. The senior rater doesn't necessarily know if you do this, this, and this, you'll definitely get this rating. They can't say that. That's kind of where my company comes into play. You know, after this many films, we kind of have a very good feeling of what, you know, what would be the right cuts to make at what times, you know, to be able to get that lower rating. So we give a lot of specifics as to that. But the MPA will come back and say, this scene specifically was a little too strong. And you could say to them, hey, listen, you know, I think... what about if I remove this, this, and this? And their response at best will be, yeah, that may work. That very well may work. But you understand why they can't come out and just say, this and this, because the senior raters aren't the ones making the decision. It's the board members themselves.
Yes,
and absolutely. That's a way to keep it kind of, you know, a little more seamless. So you either come back and you accept the rating, or you go ahead and tell them, listen, we're going to make changes to the picture, and we'll bring it back into you, and in which case you make changes, and you resubmit the picture. And if you get the rating you want, great. If you don't, you can go back and you can submit it as many times as you'd like. As long as you don't accept the rating, there's no additional cost to resubmit the film for them to try to get a lower rating.
Well, now, when you don't get the rating you want, you go through this appeals process, and out of the 758 films that were submitted last year, as Michael mentioned, 4 out of them were were appealed, and 50% of those appeals were successful. In 2010, there were 7, and 50% of those appeals were successful. And already, even before April, we have 8 films.
Yeah, no, I think I'm not sure why that is. I don't know if there's actually a root reason for it. It's just appeals have been in the press a lot more, and filmmakers are, you know, just happen to have films that are a little bit stronger that are pushing the border more. It's no secret that studios get the publicity off of an appeal. But all the ones that I've worked on recently are absolutely set in stone. They should have been, you know, the ring should have been overturned. And, you know, speak about Bully, I know it's been in the press a lot lately, and I don't want to speak to it too much, but I mean, that's one of those films that, you know, common sense dictates that the movie should be PG-13. I mean, we've shown this movie to thousands of parents across the country, and the reaction is, why isn't it PG-13? So that's one case where the appeal process, you know, should typically have come into play and overturned. And unfortunately, you know, the Weinstein Company lost by 1 rating on that one. But other appeals I've worked on, you know, we've been very successful on as well. That's what it's in place for. That's why the appeal process is there, to get people, you know, other people to look at it other than the MPA to overturn it. And the appeals board is made up of, you know, the major member studios of the MPA, the Big Six, plus exhibitors and distributors as well from, you know, from other studios. So that's the chance for a studio to, without making changes to the picture, overturn the rating and get a different rating for the film.
The general impression of the MPA is that they frown on sex and don't mind violence. That's what people's general idea is. And the result is probably that films are more violent than they would be otherwise, and probably have less nudity, intimacy, and sex than they might otherwise. That's what people think. Mm-hmm. Do you think, dealing with the MPA over all these years, do you think it's actually broken, or do you think the system's working pretty well?
The issue I think they have sometimes is that the board, in my opinion, sometimes votes on what they feel American parents would, how they would feel about a film, as opposed to what they really feel. We've done research screenings before in the past with films that have come in with a certain rating and an appeal, like Blue Valentine we worked on last year, the appeal for that. Unfortunately, that was overturned. We did a lot of research screenings with just parents in the audience, asking the parents, what rating do you feel like this movie should receive? And at the time, the MPA had anonymously given the film an NC-17. The entire board said NC-17, and we screened it for parents, and it was somewhere in the upper 70% said, absolutely not, this movie's an R. There's no way this is a PG-13. So I think a lot of times the board, you know, picture yourself sitting in a room and watching a film, and your job is to say, you know, what rating the film should receive. I think it's pretty easy to get potentially stuck in a, well, this is how I think someone else would feel about it, because they're there to, you know, be the voice of the American, you know, American parents. And it's a tough position to be in, because you don't want to necessarily do something where people are going to come back and say, you know what, you're wrong. Are you nuts? There's no way that movie should have been PG-13. So I think they're a little more hesitant to be, you know, to really say how they feel about a film. As opposed to, you know, just their actual opinion, you know what I mean? As opposed to the American population, how they'd feel.
So it's hard, and they're trying to second guess what the American public might think should be the rating. And in fact, if a third of the country thinks it should be NC-17, maybe that wasn't such a bad call. Though I love that movie, Blue Valentine, and everyone should see it. However, I wonder, is there something you would change, if you could, about the rating system and how it works?
No, I think, I think it's a good system. I really do. And you know, it's one of the things I always say to my clients is I believe in the system. That said, I mean, it's a system made up of people. I mean, there's always going to be flaws in the system. It's always going to be a bit tricky at times for it to work 100% correctly. I mean, I think the MPA goes out there and they do research. They just did a Nielsen study on language, and they try to, try to correct and try to change for, you know, social norms and adjust. And I just don't think they're changing fast enough sometimes. I mean, the language in a film like Bully, is in fact language that my wife is a teacher, and she hears a middle school teacher, and she hears these words 100 times a day, and she's in a, you know, suburban district, and these are, you know, 10 or 11 year olds. They say it all the time. It's common vernacular for them. So for, you know, parents not to, you know, for the ratings board to say this is something that is our level that a parent has to go with their kid to see is kind of a big shift from the reality. I mean, the reality is they know these words. They hear them all the time.
My 7-year-old just the other day came home from the first grade and spelled out the F-bomb for me. And, you know, I didn't
as
know
long,
whether
as long as they spell it correctly.
And that, I said, well, I'm not quite sure how, you know that, but, you know, it's good that you spelled it correctly. And apparently the boy who taught her that got, you know, sent to the principal's office. But needless to say, let me ask you this. The Classification and Rating Administration, which gives these films the rating that they receive, this was something that was set up by Jack Valenti and the MPAA as kind of a self-governing, self-censoring system. But is it the law? Do you have to have a rating? Can't you say, you know what, I'm not going to submit this for rating because that rating is going to be too restrictive.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to go out without a rating. And I can release a film legally in the U.S. without a rating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and here's the thing. Before 1968, it was essentially county-controlled or state-controlled boards that looked at these films and, you know, and gave them the rating and said what rating it should be. And the issue with that is it starts to get close to government censorship, a lot of these things. And you look at other countries and their films are censored all the time. Like, you cannot have certain things in the film. So I think the system works really, you know, well at its core. But the issue is you can absolutely submit a film without a rating. You just go out unrated. The only issue is you run into problems with advertising. A lot of advertisers won't take an unrated movie, advertising for an unrated movie. A lot of exhibitors won't show a movie if it's unrated, except for when you get into the art house cinemas. Typically, you can talk to them and get a release. But the major chains usually won't carry an unrated film. And then DVD sales, some of the major retail outlets won't take a film that's unrated, although that's loosening more and more nowadays. A lot of the unrateds are some of the bigger sellers, and they know that. But yeah, you can do it. There's just a lot of, you know, a lot of limitations. But if you're a filmmaker and you really feel passionate about a movie and you don't want to make changes, you know, you can do it. Absolutely. You can say, forget this, I'm not rating the film, and you could send it to theaters. You're just going to be a little bit more limited on how far you can reach.
Well, let me ask you this, and I know it's a legal question, because as you mentioned, the 6 major Hollywood studios, they are in on the MPAA. They're the ones that funded and provide all the resources. And it seems like a lot of the appeals or the films that get appealed are from smaller groups like or smaller studios or distributors like a Lionsgate, like a Relativity Media, like a Weinstein. And you just said something very interesting. You said, this is kind of a two-part question. You said, hey, you don't have to get rated, but then you can't play in movie theaters. So in a way, you kind of do have to get rated if you want to show your film in certain theaters and actually want it to make its money back. So at what point is there a restraint of trade clause that, or not clause, but concern between the six major Hollywood studios that kind of fund the MPAA and all of these smaller players?
Well, I think, here's the thing, six major studios, they're under contract where they have to submit the ratings, so they don't have an option not to submit the ratings as part of the deal. And it's not true necessarily that they fund them. It's every studio that submits a film pays a ratings fee equal to their ratings fee to submit the film. So it's not just, you know, it's not just them that pay the fee. Everybody kind of pays the fee. I don't think they're under too much of an advantage or disadvantage, though. I just think they're such big players and they've played this game, you know, just as I have for so many years, that they become familiar with it and they know what the best move is and what the best strategy is to make sure the true rating of the film comes through. I think the small independent studios aren't as acute to the details of the system and how to, you know, how to get something through correctly. And that's why I think it's, you know, it feels like they're at a disadvantage when in reality it's just the system itself that's putting them at a disadvantage and not the MPAA putting them at a disadvantage.
So the MPAA is not, I thought it was a trade organization composed of the six major Hollywood studios.
It is. It's made up of the six major studios, but every time you pay a ratings fee, that goes to pay for the fee for rating your film, just as they do as well.
Okay.
It is made up of them. That is true. But they're not under a, there's not a different set of rules that they follow. And they don't, you know, they don't pay anything differently. You know what I mean? We pay as they pay.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. So it's the funding issue. Okay.
Did you see the film, The Hunger Games?
I haven't seen The Hunger Games, believe it or not. I was in Texas at a convention this weekend and I meant to go and I just never made it by there, but I've just not my kind of movie, but I watch on average, you know, 10 or 15 films a week for clients, so I I don't get out to the movies as much as I should, and that's not a film that was on top of my list to see, although I've read the books.
The movie did get a lot of attention this week, and talking to parents with kids and whether they felt it was appropriate or not appropriate. My brother's wife found the movie kind of upsetting because it was, she knew it was about kids killing other kids, but when you see it on screen, it's kind of shocking. At PG-13, I think is probably the right level, though I certainly, what happens is when a movie's PG-13, it means parents bring 12, 11, and 10-year-olds and sort of think, you know, it's all right. But in fact, this movie is quite violent, and it does raise the issue of, you know, that level of violence versus sex that we have in Hollywood, that prejudice against sex and that sort of increase in violence that we see more and more in movies.
Yeah, it's a strange correlation. I mean, I definitely see that as well, and I think the root of it is, you think about kids and from a parent's perspective, kids would watch, if you sat there and watched a movie that's violent with your son or daughter, I don't think you'd be as disturbed about it as you would seeing full nudity, which, right or wrong, I don't think it's right at all, but I just think that most parents think that way. I think you watch violent, kids play violent video games all day long, but if you have, you know, have a video game that has nudity in it, it feels like so off-putting to parents, because although these kids are learning about these things when they're eight years old now, sexuality in school, it's something that's still a bit of a taboo, as opposed to, you know, violence, which a lot of times, like the Lord of the Rings series is a perfect example. It's fantasy violence, and these kids see this all the time. So what's the big deal? They know it's not real, you know, when in reality, it may not be the truth.
Well, Ethan Noble, the head of Motion Picture Consulting, is it Motion Picture Consulting Group or just Motion Picture Consulting?
LLC. Motion Picture Consulting, LLC.
Well, thank you for taking the time to join us. We will place a link to your website in the show notes. Do you have a Twitter account we should be plugging?
No, we don't do Twitter yet. Probably should, but don't.
Well, thank you for helping us try and unravel the rating system and why there have been, at least this year, 8 films out of what will probably be around 700 that have already been appealed, and only one overturned.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. It was a pleasure being on today.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right,
take care. Bye-bye.
That was interesting of Ethan to join us. Fascinating discussion. I mean, I think he's right in the sense that it does basically work okay. I don't know how you tweak the MPAA board or make it more open so that it can more readily reflect the culture and people today and try and end that bias against sex and towards violence. You know, it's, again, nudity is in context. If you see a mother breastfeeding a child in a movie, that's not upsetting. Or if you just see a body, that should not be upsetting. Or, if, you know, it's like you see a nude woman, that's okay. But if you see a nude man, that's somehow awful and has to be an R. All those sort of weird little quirks that are in a, I don't think they're natural. I don't think parents necessarily think that they are the way things should be. And I think he was putting himself in the mindset of parents, just like he said the MPA tries to do. Sometimes, you know, what do you feel comfortable with? Instead of worrying about what you think everybody else might think or do, you should focus on that.
Well, and Ethan was talking about that. You know, the one thing I forgot to ask him was about this board, this appeals board, the identity of those members. And I think there's 9 members on the appeals board. You know, they are kind of a secret. It's a big secret. They don't let that out. Nobody talks about who those members are. And a couple
or how
years,
long they stay on there or what their makeup is, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Now, I happen to know 3 or 4 of them, but
wow.
And they've been there for years. So okay. I can tell you that, you know, how long they stay there? For a long time. But yeah. I was actually at Sundance a couple of years ago watching a Kirby Dick documentary called This Film Is Not Yet Rated, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting next to, it just turns out, my neighbor. This was back in 2004, 2005, I think. And he was my neighbor in real life.
Did you know he was a member of the board at that point?
I did not. And I knew he was a film buyer for a motion picture chain, motion picture theater chain. But I did not know he was on the board. And all of a sudden, you know, Kirby Dick says, we're going to tell you who these board members are. And they start flashing these names on the screen. And his name comes up, and I just looked at him, and I said, I think you just became a celebrity. And he just, like, slunk down in his seat.
Well, you know, I think there's ways. I think openness is always good, and I think there's no reason to have the people be so secretive and anonymous, and there should be a better mix of people, and they should change them up more often. I think there's no reason why a board of the community should stay the same for 20 years. That's a long, long time to be seeing movies like that. And I think there's a lot of ways to improve the MPA without changing their basic function, which I do think works pretty well. When you had that patchwork quilt where you had to go to every county and have each person there ask for their own trims or their own changes and give it their own writing, that's a nightmare. It's just not a practical thing to do in a country of 350 million people.
Well, that wraps up our show for this week. As always, we urge you to subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher. Or even your favorite podcatcher or an RSS reader. You can get an email every time we post another episode. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Our username on both social networks is ShowbizSandbox. You can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, along with links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's show and Ethan Noble's website for motion picture consulting. That's hard to say really fast.
Sperling, where can we find you online?
Where can you find me? You can find me at celluloidjunkie.com. And what about yourself, Michael?
MichaelGiltz.com.
Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Until next week, play nice.